Welcome, Green Future Growers. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. I am just super excited to introduce my featured guest, Christy Waterworth, who I found when I was researching harlequin bugs for, I think it was somebody in the Facebook group had asked about what to do about harlequin bugs. And I found this great article she had written on gardening know-how. And I reached out to her and she's kind enough to come share her gardening and blogging knowledge with us today and just teach us a little bit more. So welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast, Christy.
It is absolutely fantastic to be here today.
Well, we're excited to talk to you. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a copywriter. I was trained as a journalist, but the small town newspaper concept is something that isn't really, not something that is really a viable career path for most people these days. And so I converted to copywriting about 7 years ago. Which is how I got into writing for gardening channels. I grew up in Southwest Missouri on a small beef operation. So it was really important that we had a vegetable garden, you know, because it helped feed us through the year. And of course, the small town I grew up in, you know, everybody gardened. My grandmother had ox olives just all over the place. She had like a bajillion little pots of it and African violets. And so, you know, it was just always kind of a part of the culture that I grew up in. So when I was offered an opportunity to do some gardening content for Demand Media, which is that's who produces eHow, or used to produce eHow, I took it, and that from there I went over to Gardening Know-How because of some mutual friends that worked there, and so that's kind of where we are today, I think.
So can I, and you, we can take this out of
here. Sure, that's
fine. Are you a millennial?
No, I am not. I am 37 years old. Okay. I am in that in-betweener, that like, you know, that's that little generation that is between the millennials and the Gen Xers. That's what I am. It's like a four or five year span. I can't remember what
I
they call
know.
That.
I count you close enough. I think there's a special group of people that are between like 30 and 40, or maybe now they're between like 32 and 42, that just are really rock stars. But I love millennials, and you're definitely just right up there in that close, because I think my stepdaughter's 37 and I thought she was a millennial.
Well, so it depends on,
I thought it was people born between 1980 and 2005.
Yeah, it depends on how you define it. There's a marketing definition, and then there's the sociological definition. And for marketing purposes, I probably am a millennial because I consume content in a lot of the similar ways. I only got my first smartphone like 2 years ago, but as soon as I got it, I was like, I am addicted to this thing. And so, yeah, I mean, in that way, I read like a millennial. But then there's some other things I do that are more like Gen X, because I didn't grow up with a computer. I didn't have a computer until I was, I mean, we had like an Apple IIe when I was like 15. But that was the first time I'd ever seen a computer in my whole life, you know, where like most millennials, I think one of the big defining characteristics with them as far as marketing goes is that we see that they are, they're PC native or they're computer native. You know, they grew up understanding that language, whereas for my generation, for our like sub generation, we got it as teenagers. So we're semi-fluent, if that makes sense.
It totally does. And I remember when I got my first iPod Touch, like I was working at the Apple store and I'm like, what the heck is an iPod Touch? And they're like, it was right before Christmas and the kids are just coming and buying them. I mean, we're just handing them hand over fist because this was in New York and it was just a busy store.
Yeah.
But when I got mine for Christmas that year, I was like, how did I ever live without this? Totally understand.
That is exactly how I felt about my smartphone. Like I run several aspects of my business just off of it now, which is crazy. But it's like
I know. I tell people all the time. I'm like, are you kidding? I'm like, I'm waiting in line. I'm going to be doing something. Like, and this, I don't know.
It, yeah, literally,
I totally understand.
But hey, it literally has more computing power than like the, you know, the whole bank of computers that sent up the Apollo 13. You know, Really?
I'm not
It's
surprised. Yes,
insane.
they are. I know. I'm just like look at it sometimes every day, and I'm like, how do you do this
How
still?
do we do this, but we
Anyway.
deny climate change? Sorry.
Excellent. Do you want to tell us, like, was your grandparents farm organic, or like, how did you learn organic techniques or earth-friendly techniques? Like, how did you pick up on that? Or was it in college, or?
Well, I mean, that's the thing is that you didn't, I mean, organic wasn't really a thing then, or at least it wasn't a thing we knew about, you know, but we weren't really, and that's what I tried to explain to you when you messaged me. We never were really, you know, like 100% organic. We do what's necessary. We did what was necessary to keep the animals from being sick. You know what I mean? Like antibiotic free. And pesticide free is all good and fine until you have a problem, like a major problem. And then sometimes you get to a point where it's cruelty to deny that. And so, you know, we used antibiotics when it was necessary, not every day. You know, like we have a cow that has pink eye. You give it an antibiotic. You don't just force it to suffer. You
Exactly.
know, but I mean, as far as our garden went, though. You know, we had a lot of manure laying around. We had cow waste to deal with, so that was a big portion of what we used. Just it's just what we had. You know, we had compost and we had cow manure and we had, you know, hay that was rotting in the back of the barn, and that's the kind of stuff you use because that's what you have. And you know, being in Southwest Missouri, there are a lot of folk ways and a lot of folk. Not medicine, because that's not really the right word when you're talking about gardening, but a lot of like folk tradition as far as like how you deal with certain kinds of things, you know, like oh, you have this kind of pest. Well, like you have deer. Deer is a great example because we have so many deer there. You know, and one of the ways that you know they say to get rid of deer in Southwest Missouri is you hang, you know, you put a fence up and you hang onions on it. Because they don't like the smell of onions. Now, I don't really think that works. I think that works if you don't have deer. If you just think you do, but you don't actually have deer. What does work though is like you have old pie pans and you have like anything that make a lot of noise that it bangs against a fence post. Now that works like really well because deer are skittish, like rabbits.
That's awesome. You know, I don't think anybody's mentioned anything like that. Last year we hung Mike's like the awards that he'd won at the fair, the ribbons all around it, but I think that would be a great idea to hang things that make
Yeah,
noise.
with
And that scares rabbits too, because we've been worried about
yeah, well, with
rabbits.
different kinds of skittish pest animals, it will work. Sometimes it only works to a point. You've got to kind of rotate your scare traps. But yeah, I mean, if they can be kept in by a fence, rabbits, in particular, the best thing to do for rabbits, the best thing to do for rabbits and deer both is fencing. But deer require an 8 to 10 foot tall fence, which is a pretty strong order for most people. But with rabbits, what you ought to do is dig a little trench around your garden and put wire down about 2 feet deep at it, like about a 45-degree angle with a bend, you know, so like it attaches to your fence and then it has like a 45-degree angle because they'll dig under. And with so many of these like pest things, it's just a matter of mechanical control. Like you don't, if you can stop it before it becomes a major problem, then you don't even have to get anything else involved. It's just a lot of labor. But when you're setting up a
Awesome. This is so timely because deer and rabbits and mice and critters have been a big questions in my Facebook group, and I've seen different places a lot of people. So I love these tips. I call them golden seeds
Yeah.
that you're dropping for listeners.
Well, this
So
is a lot of what I have done for the last, boy, how long since I've been at Demand? I don't know, at least 7 years. And I somehow managed to carve out a niche as a pest specialist. I have not trained in this in any way, shape, or form, so don't get me wrong there. But
But you've been studying
I
it,
have been.
right?
I wrote over
It sounds like.
1,200 articles about it for Demand Media. So I've had some
My
research.
God. Wow. Well, how about So one of my listeners talked about like burying wine bottles. And so like then the, like with the top side up and then the wind would whip. Like, have you heard of anything like that?
I haven't heard of that in particular. If it's really windy though, I could see that working for animals that are real spooky, you know, like maybe with the rabbit.
She was trying to get rid of like gophers.
Yeah, I don't see that working for gophers. But gophers are, no, it's moles. Never mind. Gophers are a pain. It's, a lot of people think moles are a big problem, but it's usually gophers. And for some reason, my brain, I like it flips it around. But moles, you know, they live really low in the soil and they don't really eat garden stuff. They don't eat plants so much. They usually eat like worms and grubs and things like that. So they can do damage if the water table gets too high, you know, and it kind of forces them up, but they don't really like to get up close enough to where your plant roots would be. So, that's just an aside that does not matter. Anyway, but yeah, gophers are a big problem and they're just really hard to deal with, to be honest. We had a dog that would dig them up. That's a terrible, like, get a dog and teach it to dig them up. But I mean, that's literally how we dealt with them.
That's kind of what keeps them out of our place is like, I mean, we have 20 acres of forest land. So, but we, knock on wood, haven't had gophers get in our, because I think the dogs just keep them at bay, like in the outside the fenced in the area. They just, you know, they run around and just seem to do a good job.
I mean, that is absolutely what worked on our farm. My grandfather always had, you know, a couple, three beagles running around. We had this big old farm dog. He was half collie and half German Shepherd, and so we always had a bunch of dogs around. They had nothing better to do.
So I know you just moved to Texas, but like, are you planning a garden now? Do you have a garden growing this year?
Right now we are in a rental as we're making our transition. So I don't have a garden at the moment. I have a couple of plants on the patio. I've never been able to grow a banana before because it's always been too cold. And so I have a Musa Zebrina, which is, it's called the blood banana. And it has these big green leaves with like red splotches on it. I have that growing in a pot because as soon as I saw it at the Home Depot, I squealed a little bit and then I sort of ran slow motion towards it. And my husband is like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "It's a Musa Zebrina." He's like, "What the hell is that?" And so we had a fight at the Home Depot. but yeah, I mean, I'm doing a lot of looking and learning right now. Like I drive through these neighborhoods where they have a lot of like ornamentals and you don't really see a lot of trees in the part of Fort Worth is kind of an interesting area because there's like prairie and I can't think of what the other thing, what they call it when we pull it up on like the map, but there's prairie and then there's like actual decent farmland and everything kind of colliding here. So where we're at, we're more prairie. So the sand is really the soil is really sandy. And so I think it's going to be trickier to grow things here, but I'm not, you know, Southwest Missouri, in Southwest Missouri, you learn how to grow in really bad conditions because there's almost no topsoil. Everything has, your garden is going to be more rock than dirt. And what dirt you have is probably clay. When I was a kid, my dad used to pay us to pick up rocks out of the garden. And we're not talking about a small garden. You know, this is a really big garden. And probably bigger than my yard here in Fort Worth, but I live in one of these like modern subdivisions where you don't need apparently a yard. But so yeah, I have chickens. You can guess how happy my neighbors are. But we're going to buy a house here in about a year and then everything will be okay again. And we will be putting out some kind of summer. I think what's best here, because the summers are really hot. So I think what's going to work best is like a two season, you know, like two separate growing seasons, kind of like they do in Florida, where like we'll start in like February, have starts ready for February and plants in February and then harvest by like May, maybe May or June. And then it's going to get like hotter than the sun. And then I understand in September, the temperature's going to start dropping again. So then we'll do like September to November or December. I mean, when I got here in February, I was wearing like spring dresses because it was so hot and humid. Oh. So I think that you've got, I think this will be a good place to do two season cut gardens. But I don't really have any friends here that are local or that have any gardening experience, so I don't have a good feel for that.
Well, I was going to say, I have a lot of listeners in Texas, so you should tell people. So how often do you blog at the Gardening Know-How? Like, do you do it regularly, like once a week, month, does it come out a week? Or like, do you just when they have a question, or like, how does that work? Because I'll bet listeners are going to want to follow you
there. Well, I work for the woman who owns the site, and she sends me a package of questions that need to be answered. I get them five at a time, and I usually do about 10 a month. So if you go to the site and you ask a question, a gardening question of the Gardening Know-How experts, there's I think there's seven of us now. Somebody who knows stuff will get back to you. Whether or not it becomes an article will depend on how frequent that particular question is asked. So like if somebody comes and they ask something just totally out there, like way out in left field that no one has ever thought to ask before, probably Heather will just jump in there and answer it herself. But if 40 people come in and they ask about how to deal with, you know, palmetto bugs, which are really gross, by the way, super gross flying cockroaches. Ugh. Anyway.
What do they get on?
I don't know. We don't have them here, but they're nasty. Anyway, people ask about, you know, a specific kind of bug or whatever, then that'll filter down to me. It might not be immediate. It might take a while because I only get, you know, so many a month, but that's kind of how that works. It's sort of not the exact same way it works at Demand, but fairly close. They, at Demand Media, if you ever pick up any of the old eHow articles, I mean, most of them are still pretty well, you know, gardening doesn't change a whole lot from year to year. So most of them still have some pretty decent content in them, and they were picked up. They designed those articles by aggregating questions that came out of Google. So somebody would go to Google and they would type in, you know, how much compost do I need to put in my garden? Then it would all filter back. If enough people asked that question, it would filter back into their system, which was all kind of automated, and then people did like manual checks on it. And it would come down to the writers to figure out the answer to these questions. And by the way, the answer to that question is about 25% of the depth of the garden you're going to have. So if you want to, say, dig a garden 8 inches deep across it, you're going to want to put 2 inches of organic materials in the fall, not in the spring. This is a really common problem. You put them in the fall, that way they have time to break down. And you do a soil test in the spring to make sure that everything's cool before you put your plants in. I have had this question asked me of me so many times, I just thought I would go ahead and answer it.
That's interesting, because I don't know that anybody's said that specifically on our show, like 25% of the depth you're going to have. So like, if you have like a bed that's 2 feet deep, you're going to put a half a foot of compost?
Yep. Cool. Up to 25%. You don't want to exceed that, because at some point, depending on the compost you use, some of it has got high salt content, especially if it's from an animal source. Because like cows and even goats and like I used to have llamas on my farm, they all need like salt supplements, and then they go on and they pass that, you know, in their poo and their urine. And so you want to make sure that you don't over salinate your garden, because that will kill everything.
Awesome. That's good too. I don't think anybody said that. You were just dropping. I knew you would drop a lot of golden seeds for this.
Well, that's good. I mean, this has been almost 7 years of work, so I'm glad people are learning things. or are going to be learning.
Well, I think you should put a book together.
I have considered it. I actually have. I have one that I'm working on. It's let me find the title because I don't want to quote it wrong because it's. I thought I was really clever when I wrote the title. Oh, let's see.
Now remember what John Lee Dumas always says: if you have a choice between clever and clear, make sure you're clear first.
No,
if you can be clear and clever.
No, I'm just clever. That's all. I am never clear. That's the number one rule in journalism too: is to be your first goal is to communicate, and then your goal is to entertain. Boy, I don't even see it. It should have been right there. Anyway, it was something like "Liar, liar, plants on fire." 10 common gardening myths and, you know, whatever. So that
I love that.
That was my ebook title. And I was working on it when I was at Demand because we get so many of these like weird, really weird questions. I was like, no, you shouldn't duct tape your plants. Why are you asking me this? What is this?
All you need is duct tape.
Duct tape fixes
and everything will be all right.
That's right. And if you can't...
There was a song about duct tape that we used to sing all the time.
If you can't fix it with duct tape, you don't need it. You guys are... you're not always... Haven't always been up north, though, have you? It sounds like you were in New York for a while.
Yeah, I grew up on Long Island, and I moved to Montana when I was 20.
Oh, I see. Well, I was going to say up there in Canada. Man... My workout today must have killed me. Up there in Canada, they have or used to have the Red Green show. And, you know, he was very pro duct tape.
I guess I don't know what
you don't know the Red Green show? Oh, my goodness, Jackie, that is sad.
What's that?
Oh, you would love the Red Green show. Everyone loves the Red Green show. It's hilarious. He was a Canadian, and he duct taped everything. Here, I'm going to send you a link to this, and you can find him on YouTube and probably maybe on Netflix. I don't know.
Okay.
The Red Green Show. He kind of did like a fake fix-it type program, except that it was always just horrible. Like, everything he did was like, it just made you just cry. And, but his big thing was, you know, his big shtick was the duct tape. When I was a kid, it was on PBS, and I was like, man, this is an awesome show. And my dad being my dad growing up on a farm and being a mechanic and everything, it was, you know, he thought it was hilarious. So I...
All right, well, I'll have to check that out. We'll put the link in the show notes for listeners. That sounds fun. Yeah, we are just 7 miles from the Canadian border. So we definitely have our share of Canadians around.
Yeah, you guys. I'm sure your Canadian listeners know Red Green quite well. If we could pick him up in Southwest Missouri, I'm sure that he managed to pick up at least some of those guys. Anyway, yeah. I'm sorry. I am bad about going way off topic.
Hey, green future growers, do you love to listen to audio as much as I do? Have you ever tried an audiobook? As a fan of this podcast, you must already enjoy listening to stories just like I do. Well, the Organic Gardener podcast has teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook. Just go to www.organicgardenerpodcast.com/book or just type book into the search bar at theorganicgardenerpodcast.com and you can get entered to get listening to your first audiobook today. Organifi Green Juice is a gently dried superfood mix that supports health, mental clarity, while detoxifying your body all in one delicious drink. What I love about Organifi, it makes me feel great. It's easy. It doesn't take much time. It's full of nutrients and superfoods that I have a hard time getting anywhere else, and it just tastes delicious. Now, as a teacher, you all know that our time is totally limited. I have kids in my classroom from 7:30 in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. So just even using this simple thing can be difficult for me, but I can pull it off and so can you. If you want to feel good and get all your greens in a simple, easy drink, remember, you can get a discount as an Organic Gardener podcast listener by entering code OGP16, and Organifi will give you a 15% discount now. So just go to Organifi.com, and when you go to checkout, enter code OGP16, and they'll give you 15% off your order anytime. So this is kind of like the part where I say, let's get to the root of things. And I ask, like, do you have a activity that's like your least favorite activity to do in the garden that you got to kind of force yourself to get out there and do?
Yeah, actually. And this is one that when you see articles that I've written, I always give this advice, the specific advice, because it's really important to helping keep disease down. You know, at the end of the growing season, you get, you know, you've got all that like stubble and dead plants and stuff that need to be dealt with. Well, you need to deal with those like right away. Like as soon as they're done, you need to plow them under or pull them up or whatever you're going to do with them, and not leave them there to attract like mold and you know, different kinds of problems. But I am the world's worst about not doing that. Like, I just don't want to mess with it. In fact, in Missouri, you know, you plant out in, like, tomatoes, for example. You plant your tomatoes in May, around May 15th. And they produce and they produce and they produce. And then it gets to be August. And it's just hotter than the surface of the sun. And it's humid and it's horrible and you don't want to go outside. I don't even go out and water my tomatoes. I'm just like, you guys are on your own. And if they make it, great. And if not, I don't care. I'm just done. I'm like, I don't care anymore. It's too hot. And
I know that feeling. I don't like the heat at all.
So I am the world's worst.
But isn't it good to let your tomatoes kind of like not water them the last 2 weeks or so anyway?
Tomatoes are actually, if you go back to where tomatoes came from, to the like the original, you can't see me doing air quotes, but I'm doing air quotes. The original tomato plant, because they're all, you know, the genetics are still the genetics. You just kind of, you're selecting specific traits, but they're all still kind of pretty much the same thing. So you go back to the tomatoes we started with. They were basically wild vines that were growing in South America. So they're coming from hardy stock to begin with, and they really prefer to be neglected. But you don't want to neglect them to the point that, like, you know, the grass is dead and you're not going to water them. Like, they need to be watered some or they're just not going to make it. You just, you know, you just kind of spread it out. Like, you water them once a week instead of watering every day, unless they're in pots. And that is really important distinction to make, because if anything that's in a pot and it's really, really hot out, if you don't water it daily, it's going to die. So that's my advice to you. Don't water your tomatoes.
You are so knowledgeable.
I love how, you know, you're like sucking up to me, but it's not necessary. It's okay. This is just, like I said, it's the result of 7 years of research. So I thought about going back to school and getting a degree in plant science at one point. But then I realized I wasn't going to use it for anything except for writing blogs. So I was like, what's the point in that?
What does a plant scientist do? Do they have like a nursery, or they work for like a research, like at a university, or what does somebody with a plant science degree do?
Well, what I was specifically looking for was something that was focused on crop development. So what you would do with something like that, if you were actually going to use it, is you would work with like an extension office, or you'd work with, or like with the university, and you'd help farmers, take better care of their crops. You introduce them to newer ways of doing things that were more efficient and used less chemical control. They introduced the idea of IPM, which is integrated pest management. It's a system where you don't start with the harshest chemicals. You know, you start with whatever kind of sort of mechanical management you can do, like if you have a problem with wasps, you know, you use a trap, or Japanese beetles, they'll do like, they sometimes will come to scent attractants and things like that. And so you start with that kind of thing, and then you move kind of up the scale gradually until you hit a solution. And, you know, it depends on the density, and things like grasshoppers are just evil, wicked things from beyond the grave, and you have to hit them hard because there's no other option. But that's kind of the things that plant scientists do, or they work in research where they help to develop better types of plants that are more resilient towards things like corn. Corn is a really good example, because it's the reason that we do so much research with corn is because it is so, so, so fragile. And it is really bad about certain kinds of pests. If they're present, and we're talking about an agricultural scale, you know, not like in your backyard, they're really hard to get rid of, especially certain kinds of caterpillars, because they just can't, you can't go through every stalk. You know what I mean? You can't go through every stalk manually. There just isn't the manpower. And it would make your corn cost so much, you wouldn't be able to afford it. And so you have to have other ways to go about that. And whether that's developing sturdier stalk, or it's, finding a better method of controlling those caterpillars, or like there were some mosquitoes. This has nothing to do with crops, but this is a good example of a way to control things like that sometimes. There's a mosquito problem down in Florida, and, you know, they're like really swampy areas. And they've developed a mosquito. They have bred a mosquito that is sterile. And so what they do is they send those mosquitoes out to breed with the local population. And so it cuts down the mosquitoes by a lot, because they can't breed. And that makes life a lot easier when you live in the swamp. You know, so there's a lot of different tricks you can use with the sciencey stuff before you break out the 2,4-D, you know what I mean? Because that is, that's like nuking the world.
Yeah. So on the flip side then, what's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
My favorite activity to do in the garden is stand there and eat things.
Nice.
Like you grow, you grow some of those, we always grow those super sweet 100s on the cherry tomatoes, and you just stand there, you just eat them all and be like, I don't know why there weren't any. I think we must have problems with songbirds or strawberries.
Oh, it doesn't seem like we can ever eat all the cherry tomatoes at our house, but I love cherry tomatoes.
My dog, and my little, Jack Russell Terrier, that's her favorite thing. And apparently this isn't uncommon. My uncle, my great uncle, when I was a kid, he told me the story they had about a dog they had on the farm. And he would get in the tomatoes every year, even though they had a fence. He'd figure out how to get in there, and he'd get in the tomatoes and he'd eat them. And so one year they took one and that was still on the vine, and they kind of hollowed it out and filled it full of black pepper. Because I thought, you know, this will break the dog from doing this, because he'll be like, oh, these are really gross now. And he bit into that tomato, and they were watching him do it. And he bit into that tomato, and he stopped for a minute, and he kind of shook his head. And he bit into it again. And apparently, all they did was teach him to like black pepper.
Oh, no. Crazy.
But yeah, so that's not an uncommon thing, apparently, for dogs.
Yeah, I've seen dogs. Yesterday we were out huckleberry picking, and I've had dogs that like to eat huckleberries too.
Oh.
And Mike said the reason, I was asking him, like, how come we don't ever have strawberries? And he said it's because every time the birds eat them.
Yeah.
So, yep, definitely a problem.
The wild birds, especially.
What's the best gardening advice you've ever received?
Oh, man.
I know you have a lot, it sounds like.
Well, I've read a lot. My dad's the big gardener in our family, and I think the biggest thing, and this isn't even advice, this is just a really cool invention. So my dad, what he does with his tomato plants is like the Waterworth thing to grow are tomatoes. And we grew other stuff, like we'd have okra and we'd have onions and all that, but nobody got that excited about those. They were not nearly as exciting. But everybody's really into the tomatoes, and like that's kind of what got me going. Is I got into the heirlooms and all the different colors and the different flavors and all that. And so my dad, anyway, let me get back to my dad. So my dad has this trick that he uses every year, and what he does is instead of like standing around watering his tomato plants, which is a giant pain, or installing a drip irrigation system, which is kind of tricky to install, but also you get into a lot of expense if you're not careful. He just takes a piece of PVC pipe. He uses about half inch, but I mean, you could use an inch pipe or whatever. And he sticks it down in the ground around where the roots, you know, down to the depth of the roots or where they will be. And he fills it up with water. Like every few days, he'll just go and fill it up with water. And that's how he keeps his tomatoes watered without overwatering them. And it seems to work pretty well for him. He always has pretty good crops. I haven't really, I tried it a couple of times and I couldn't get the depth quite right. And I couldn't get the ratio of pipe length quite right. Because I know he experimented with this a lot. That's just how he is. But I couldn't quite get it right. And I just don't worry about it. I just throw out a soaker hose or something if I have to. Because I am the nice. Ultimate in lazy. You have no idea. Like, I'm all about hands off. I just want to go out there and like collect food and leave.
I know how you feel. Well, my problem is usually I'm just usually busy, and it's just hard for me to like, there'll be like 3 or 4 days in a row where I won't even make it to the garden. So like watering on a consistent schedule or keeping up with weeding or things like that are really difficult for me.
Yeah, same
my
here.
My husband does a really good job of getting rid of the weeds at the beginning of the year. And then he seems to like, because he covers it with mulch. And I mean, we've always had a water shortage kind of at my house. Mm-hmm. We're experiencing some different things these last couple of years because we dug a deep well. And now we have like, we can actually turn a sprinkler on. We can water a whole area as compared to before. It was like every ounce of water went right to the roots. Like what you were growing, that was what got the water. And so that made a big difference for us. So, but I'm all about convenience. I like things that are easy, that are convenient, that are fast and effective, and just, you know, aren't going to take a lot of time because I don't always have a lot of time. And if I'm in the garden, my thing to do down there is like to paint or read a book. I've been reading a lot of books in the garden this summer and just sitting in the shade and smelling the flowers. I like to grow flowers and herbs.
Nice.
But I'm blessed with a husband who loves to grow vegetables. So we do pretty good.
Yeah. See, I mostly grow vegetables when I have my druthers, but they are so messy and they can get kind of gross. I've done quite a few articles on edible landscaping, stuff that wasn't viable where I was living, but now in Fort Worth, I may give it a shot because we can grow things here like guavas and bananas and some of these things that make good landscape plants, but also produce food for somebody, you know, so that may be something we try in the next couple of years just to see kind of if we can do it.
Cool. Well, maybe we can talk again in a couple of years and see how that went, because I think that's a popular thing with a lot of my listeners. My brother talked about like native landscaping in the suburbs in New York once, and that was a really popular episode. So that'd be good to hear about. How about your favorite tool? Like if you had, when you moved, was there, like if you could have only taken one tool with you, what would you not have left behind?
I left quite a few tools behind. It was, you know, we had to make those hard calls because the truck was only so big and it wasn't like you could do a return trip. And,
so what came with you?
The biggest thing that I brought, honestly, and I don't know if you would want to count this as a garden tool, but the one thing that I brought with me that I can remember right now was a weed eater. And it's because I have an electric, like one of those battery powered electric self-feeding weed eaters. I love that thing. I use it for everything. And a lot of people don't use them in the garden because you have to be really precise. But when you know, if you use the guard just right and everything, it can help keep the weeds and stuff down. But, you know, like with the garden plants, when it gets really, really hot in the summertime, sometimes it helps to have a little bit of extra cover over the root system, as long as you don't let it get out of hand. You know what I mean? Like you keep you let a little bit of grass grow to kind of keep the roots insulated. but you don't let it get very tall. So you just run in between the rows with Weed Eater and you don't have to worry about it. But
Mike does a lot of weeding, and finding a good weed eater has been a challenge for us over the years.
Oh, there.
And what is it? It has like an automatic.
It auto feeds. You don't have to bump it.
Yeah.
And it's just a Black & Decker battery powered weed eater. It's the second one I've owned, and I really love them. I love them in a way that is unnatural.
Maybe you could send me the link to that, because I know Mike does a lot of weed eating. We have a pretty big place, so that would be cool. How about a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
Normally in the summertime we do, you know, we don't really cook a lot. We do a lot of just like whatever's laying around cold. Like we'll just cut up some tomatoes and toss them with some salt, and there you go. And throw some like chicken next to it or whatever. But as far as things I have cooked in the past, one of the things that I used to, when I had a really, really big garden, I'd grow like 75 or 80 tomato plants at once. It sounds like this whole interview is about me and tomatoes, and it's a weird sort of relationship I have with them. The thing is that you can freeze them solid, whole. You can just throw them in the freezer whole, like in a bag. And since I was growing, guys, settle down. Since I was growing all these different varieties of heirlooms at the time, you know, like there, I grow one, at least one of each color. And I would separate them out in bags in this like giant chest freezer I had. And so when I got, you know, towards the end of the season, I would take each individual bag and I would make, you know, like certain colors of sauce. I would make certain colors of ketchup. And it's because I have a problem with sorting, apparently. But some simple stuff like tomato sauce out of the garden, or, you know, like, because everything else we just kind of like, you know, if you grow corn, we just throw that on the grill. We don't really, you know, it's not really a recipe as such. Cucumbers, we just, you know, salt them and go to town. You know, we can't really grow like potatoes or anything like that in Missouri. There's just too many rocks. So I guess I don't really have, like, as far as like a recipe goes, we don't really, there's not really anything to recipe.
I think just telling people that you can put a tomato right in the freezer in a plastic bag.
Yeah, you totally can. I was really sick that year, and I was so tired. I was like, I cannot peel these and put these in a bag. You know what? I'm just going to throw them in the freezer. And I pulled them out a few months later, and I was like, you just boil them long enough to slip the skins off, or don't. I mean, I just put them in the food processor because lazy. And and they just zip away.
So do you, when you put them in the freezer, do you put them like on a cookie sheet? Like I've heard people that talk about putting blueberries or fruit in the freezer. They put it on a cookie sheet first, just right in the bag.
I just threw them in a bag, put them in the freezer.
I love that.
It's not easy.
A favorite internet resource? Is there somewhere on the web that you go to first or that you can recommend?
Do you really want me to answer that question? Because the answer is gardening know-how, obviously.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Okay. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine, or is there a blog?
I actually do have a favorite book, and let me pull up the exact title of it off of Amazon, because this is one of the best books I have ever read for gardeners. And I think it's in the fifth printing now. There it is. Okay. It is called My Favorite Book for Gardeners. It's called Botany for Gardeners by Brian Capon. The reason why I like this book is that it explains how plants work in a really simple, simple way that anybody can understand. And he's got lots of illustrations, and he talks about a lot of the different, you know, he doesn't really necessarily, he kind of talks about disease a little bit, but the biggest thing for me is it explains how all the structures work inside of a plant. And that way, like when you hear some of these like folklore type remedies, you go, you know, that doesn't really make sense. at all once you understand how plants work, because I think for so many people, they're really kind of like an alien species. Like, plants are as alien to us as octopuses, you know? We don't really get how these things work, because in relation to us, they're so much different. And I think that the Botany for Gardeners book really helps to kind of, it kind of makes it make a lot more sense. This is absolutely, like I said, the best book I've ever read on gardening. And I have, like, I used to have a really big library of gardening books. It's available through, it's available as an ebook, which is great because then you don't have to carry it around. It's available as a paperback. And if your paperback is like mine, it looks like it's been went through the washer 3 or 4 times. It hasn't been, but I've just used it so much and spilled stuff on it that it's a little rough.
Those are the best kind of books.
They are. There's another one too, actually, I want to mention, which isn't, it's only kind of tangential to gardening.
All right. I think I'm going to have to get that Botany for Gardeners, though. Botany was like one of my favorite science classes. I'm not usually a big science person. Other than like biology, I hated chemistry, I hated physics. But botany, I loved.
Okay. Now, this one is actually the book that my husband and I, when we were first dating, this was the first book that we kind of talked about because I was reading it at the time. But I thought it was so fascinating. I still think it's so fascinating. In fact, I may go back and read it again today. I haven't read it in a while. It's called The Earth Moved, On the Remarkable Achievements of Earthworms. This is an Amy Stewart book. And anybody that has read, she's written quite a few gardening books. But this one in particular is literally about earthworms and how they work. And some of the different applications for earthworms and some different ways that they can change the environment around them and how the environment can change earthworm populations. And, you know, it was a book, I picked it up because I had read some other Amy Stewart stuff and I thought, well, you know, this has got to be something because she writes pretty good books. And I'm like, what is this all about? And I pick it up and I start reading it. I'm like, this is amazing. And it wasn't a game changer or anything for me, but it's a book that my husband and I have just had our 4th anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
And, oh, no, wait, it's not for a few days. Oh, but you won't, this won't run yet, though, so no one will know. Anyway, oh, man, I am bad now. I read about that time, so that was about 5 years ago, maybe, and it's still kind of stuck, you know, it's kind of stuck with me. Like, I can't shake it. Because it was just so fascinating and so unexpected. You know what I mean? Because it's such an unassuming little book.
I think this is so timely because just this morning there was a challenge on Facebook that Mike showed me where you took a pair of underwear and buried them in your garden. They had to be cotton, preferably I would think 100% organic cotton, but they just said 100% cotton underwear. And if after 2 months, and so this is this challenge, this company in this farm in California is doing this frog farm, I can't remember. And then in September, they're having like this big feast at their farm and they're going to hang all the underwear along the clothesline. And they said, if your farm is, your soil's good, if it's healthy, if it's got enough earthworms and microbes and everything, all that should be left is the waistband, and they should. And so they were calling this a really good indicator of your soil health. So I think it's really timely that we're mentioning this today.
Yeah.
Sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, microbes are really, really important to the health of your soil, of your garden. Of course, it's a little harder to do that in, you know, the smaller scale that we're talking about, because there's a lot of limitations, a lot of practical limitations that a home gardener has that a farmer doesn't. Just, you know, between like equipment and different sorts of techniques that aren't, you know, like your neighbors aren't going to like it. For example, if you run a bunch of pigs over your garden, there's just a lot of things that you just can't do. But, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of value to So that, but you could do it with, you could do it with, you know, like newspaper, or you could do it with just all kinds of things. But just because, and this is actually, I think, important to keep in mind, is just because your garden is full of, you know, the kind of like animals and bacteria and stuff that will break down waste, doesn't mean you don't also have problematic microbes like nematodes, you know. So it's kind of, you know, the world in your soil is really complicated, and it's good, and there's always good and bad together. If there's nothing, like if it's just scorched earth, that's not great. But even if there's a lot of, you know, those decomposing type creatures, you're still not necessarily in the clear. You know what I mean?
So you should still get a soil test.
Oh, dude, soil test has nothing to do with it. All a soil test will show you is what kind of nutrients are in the soil.
Oh.
If you have the right kind of nematodes are really hard to detect without spending too much money, if that makes sense.
And what do nematodes do that's so bad?
Nematodes are they have you heard of something called root knot disease or root galls?
Maybe.
If you're a lot of people will experience problems with their plants where everything else looks good, like soil test comes back clean and everything looks nice, but for some reason their plants just aren't thriving, or some of their plants are thriving and some of them aren't, even though they came from the same stock. And it's really inconsistent, and it gets worse and worse and worse, even though you can water them all day long and then they just don't look like they've been watered. Well, that's because these little microscopic roundworms get into they burrow into the roots of these plants, and they you know basically make it hard for that plant to take up nutrients and water because they're kind of it's not exactly fibrosis, but I mean, you can kind of think of it that way. They're making everything kind of hard, and it won't respond as well. And they're starting to clog up the pores and things down in the roots so that nutrients can't come up. And so when you have nematodes, they're not your friends. I mean, there may be some beneficial ones, but that's not where my focus is. So I'm not exactly a nematode expert. I come across them a lot in the literature, and it's never pleasant. You can avoid problems with nematodes a lot of times by using healthy crop rotation. So, you know, if you're growing, you know, if you're growing cruniferous plants over here, then, you know, you rotate them out with your like your grains over so many years, depending on, you know, whatever kind of nematode you've got. There, some of them have different lifespans, but usually about a 4-year crop rotation with different plant families will make a big, big difference to how well they thrive. Some gardeners, and for some nematodes, this is actually valid to an extent. I always have to go there because the marigold thing, they use marigolds sometimes as a deterrent, and the French marigolds, they have shown some efficacy at pushing back nematode colonies, but they have to be planted within 12 inches. I think it's 12 inches. I don't remember the exact measurements, but it's really, really close. So basically, if you're going to plant marigolds with your tomatoes, they need to be, and they have to be French marigolds. They need to be in sort of like a crosshatch pattern, you know, kind of like a checkerboard. So you plant, you know, your tomato here, and then you plant like a grouping of marigolds next to it, another tomato plant, and a grouping of marigolds, and you surround them all. Because what the old timers would do is they would put them around the outside of the bed, and that's all fine and good if there aren't nematodes in the soil in the center. But because they're so microscopic, it takes a long time for them to, you know, really build up. So that actually does have some merit to it, but it, you know, to really be safe, you have to plant them much more frequently than was previously believed. But of course, you know, those old time farmers didn't pick up scoops of soil and put them under a microscope either. So, you know, they did the best they could.
That's good to know. I'm going to have to go research what a French marigold was, because we've always put marigolds, but I don't know if that I've ever paid attention to what kind they are.
Do you buy the little short ones, the little shorties with like the single flower, the single, the like really basic flowers on them?
Probably.
Those are probably the French then. There's a lot of other types, but in Montana, they're probably just the two, because that's all we had in Missouri. When you just go buy flats of them, you can either get the little shorties or you get the really tall ones. And the short ones are the French marigolds, and the tall ones are African or something, Mexican. I don't know what they are. My mom liked them, but they were just for show.
I don't know. We've had like every kind of marigold, and Mike usually grows those from seed.
Yeah, they're really super easy.
Yeah, they do grow really well. So, ready for my final question?
Absolutely.
Okay, if there's one change you'd like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
How controversial are you comfortable with me getting here?
I can edit
it out.
I haven't had to edit anything yet.
Well, here's the thing. And some of your listeners may disagree with me, and that's all fine and good. But climate change is real. And in the next few years, we're going to experience this. We already are experiencing this in a very, very real way. And what I think is the most important thing right now to help the world is for the world to get its own, you know, to get its act together, and especially our country, which our leadership currently is very anti-science and doesn't seem to want to give any merit to things like global warming, because they're withdrawing funding, they're trying to get at, you know, they're backing out of the Paris Accord. And all of these things are going to lead to the end of humanity. And I don't mean this in a crazy apocalyptical sense. I mean, as in this world is getting so hot that there's not going to be anything left if we don't make some major changes. And, you know, things like improving manufacturing efficiencies, cleaning up the air and the water and just, you know, generally reducing the amount of carbon that we put into the world would make such a big difference. And all we have to do is say, yes, we are committed to trying to reduce our impact on the environment. You know, everybody is seeing these changes in the natural world around them. You can't deny it at this point, you know. Everybody last year, was it last year? We had the hottest temperatures on record, just like all over the country. And they're saying we're going to...
I think it's been like 5 or 7 out of the last 10 years.
Yeah, I was just saying they're...
Like, that's what makes it really different than like, yeah, we've had hot years in the past. We've had extreme weather in the past. But what's going on is in the last 10 years, those extreme... There's just way, way more extreme weather.
Yeah, absolutely.
Events.
And the tornadoes are getting all squirrely. Because that's something we had a lot in Southwest Missouri. We had a lot of tornadoes, but they were never... They changed. I don't know how else to describe it. They changed. There's something that happened in... let me look this up, because I don't want to tell you the wrong year. Okay, so it's called the Maunder Minimum. This is something that we covered in one of my history classes. It was a period between 1645 and about 1715 when it was caused by sunspots that were, like, for some reason the sun wasn't kicking out as many sunspots. And what happened is it caused the overall temperature of the planet to drop by, oh, I'm not sure if I can find it. It's like 2 degrees Celsius or something. It was such a small amount. It didn't, when you read about it, you're like, this doesn't feel significant. But the problem is that even just a few degrees can make, globally, can make such a difference. And, this was a natural occurrence. This wasn't caused by human intervention. But, when we're talking about, temperatures exceeding what they should be by so much more. During the Maunder Minimum, people died all over the place because agriculture failed, and Europe was just a wasteland. They had such a hard time keeping crops growing, and it was so cold. This is what they call it, the Little Ice Age, and it was so cold that they really, they had a really hard time keeping crops growing, and we are experiencing what is essentially the opposite of that. We are seeing we're seeing temperatures that are, globally, maybe a few degrees above what we expect to see, but that's, globally, that's on an average, and it has such a big impact. Like 2 or 3 degrees globally is a lot more than you would think. Like it's not two or more, 2 or 3 degrees in your neighborhood. It's two or
Right,
three degrees for
exactly.
the planet.
It's not like all of a sudden things are going to be just a little bit warmer for you in your specific space.
Exactly.
Like you're going to have 70 degree days instead of 68 degree days. It doesn't work like
Right,
that.
exactly. And it,
I'm glad you're bringing this up because I know a lot of people don't realize.
and it influences weather patterns, and it changes things, and then you have all these like chain reactions like we're seeing right now. Like you probably saw the article recently about the glaciers that are breaking off in the Arctic, and
Yeah, well, we live right next to Glacier National Park, and like the number of people that have come to the park in the last few years because they're melting, and they're not, over, what do they say? Like by 2030, they're all going to be gone. There aren't going to be glaciers in Glacier National Park. So if you want to come to Montana and visit me, listeners, let me know, and we'll go for a little hike or something down there. But definitely,
I'll have to rename the
no,
park.
the. I hope not.
Me too.
They call it it's Glacier National Park in Waterton National Park. They call the Peace Park right on the Canadian border where the two meet.
Oh, that's cool.
And so, but yeah, no, the glaciers. And I've been wanting to go on this hike because I went there with my parents back in 1990, like maybe 1989, 1990. They came out to visit me when I first moved to Montana, and we went to this place called Iceberg Lake. And this girl I taught with this summer just took a picture of her there, and it's the exact same view. And when you see the snow, when well, my parents were there, and I'm sure my parents were here in July, same time of year, and how much more snow there is in the background of the picture with me and with my parents, and compared to her, it's just crazy.
Yeah,
So.
it's terrifying. It's honestly, it keeps me up at night. Because I know that not only for us to survive this, not only do we have to make we should have made started making changes 10 years ago, we have to do that, we have to make them now. It's going to change agriculture in some very significant ways. Ways that we can't even imagine yet, because this is going to be one of those things that we either sink or swim. We either reduce carbon emissions and we clean up some of this mess that we've made, or and there's not going to be an or, because some of this is going to be left. Like we're going to, even if we turn this around, we're going to be left with scars from it. And that means we're going to have to change some of the ways to do agriculture. And what we may end up doing is, seeing a lot more like climate controlled air conditioned greenhouses, or who knows, indoor growing areas that just don't, the sun, plants never see the sun. Things like that may become a necessity, because we have got to find ways to protect our plants from what we've done to the planet, or we're going to starve to death. So yeah, so I mean, this stuff, it upsets me and it keeps me up at night, and I try not to think about it, but you asked the question, so here we are. No,
Sorry.
it's all good. We got all day.
Well, for sure, because My biggest organization is 350.org, and they're named after the amount, what is it, 350 million parts, 350 parts per million of carbon that can be in the atmosphere, and we broke 400 like a year ago. Like, we're like, what, life is not going to be the way it was, you know, when our parents were growing up. As our kids are growing up, we don't even know if there's going to be a place for our kids to grow up, because, you know, food's important. Our planet's important.
Absolutely.
And I'm so glad you opened up with us today, Christy. And I just think you've been a wonderful guest. My listeners, I call them the green future growers.
Nice.
They're all growing a greener future.
And
so I think they're really going to relate to
hey,
you.
Hey, Jackie, you yeah. just might want to make sure that your readers or your viewers, listeners, right? That your listeners know yeah. that they still have a voice in our government. And if they, you know, write to their congressmen and they call them and they make their stance known on, you know, our Paris Accord standing and our standing in the world as far as, you know, climate change goes, that there's hope that they'll listen. The more people that make noise,
yeah.
the better.
It's so true. And I tell my listeners all the time, like, even if they're on our side, even if they agree with us, they need you to call more than ever. Like, our Senator John Tester from Montana is an organic farmer. Like, but he can't do it on his own. He needs his constituents. And then here we are in Montana voting in, who did we just vote in? I don't know, but we're generally a Republican, more Republican state, but we do have our Democratic Senator, John Tester, and like, but he needs people to call in and support him. And so even if you're nervous about calling, you know, and all you're going to do is you're going to get an intern probably,
oh,
and
yeah.
they're just going to take a message, no matter whether they agree with you or not. They're going to be polite and making your voice. I mean, it's super quick. It's super easy. And it does make a huge difference. So I'm so glad you've said all these things and you're encouraging people. And just, do you have like a really like short inspirational tip or a quote or anything just to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
I mean, it's one of those things. What is it that Joe Dirt used to say? Life's a garden, dig it.
Oh, I like that. I haven't heard that.
Well, it's from a stupid comedy movie. Life's a garden, dig it.
That is so perfect. Okay, and so the website where listeners can follow your blog is gardenknowhow.com.
That's correct.
And are you on Instagram or anything like that?
I am not. Gardening Know How is on Facebook. Our team is on Facebook. And I want to say they're also on Twitter. Hold on.
Probably.
Let me see here. Let's see. These icons pop up. They may actually have an Instagram now. Yes, they do have an Instagram. And
cool.
Let's see. Twitter, Pinterest, YouTube. I did not know that. Google Plus. And then there's the blog that we've got there at gardeningknowhow.com. So
excellent. Well, thank you so much for being just an awesome guest today and sharing your journey with listeners. And I know, like I said, they're going to love this episode, and just have a wonderful day.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jackie. Just let me know when it airs so I can share it with my followers.
That'd be great. Hey, Green Future Growers. Don't forget to go to theorganicgardenerpodcast.com/2018 to get notified when the Organic Gardener Podcast 2018 journal, garden journal, and data keep it is ready. Mike and I want to help you build your very own organic oasis. And so we're kind of giving you a space to write your general garden goals for the year. There's a place to list them by month, by week, some place to record what you're eating as well as what you're growing, what you're spending the most money on, what you're digging out of your garden the most of, what recipes you're cooking, and just kind of give you an idea of what's happening with your food for 2018. So don't forget to go to organicgardenerpodcast.com/2018 to sign up on our landing page for notifications when the journal is ready. Hope you have a wonderful day, and thanks again. If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.